Thank you to the committee that chose me as the lecturer tonight. And I'd like to also provide my thanks to Leo Walsh for endowing this lectureship. The lecture allows invited speakers to address topics of a more general nature, and which gives us all a broader perspective about our science. I will try to provide that broader perspective today. The topic I'll address covers some key historical advancements leading to the development of today's modern nitrogen fertilizer industry. I'll also cover some of the history of our science, a bit about the personalities involved, and what the Haber-Bosch process has meant for feeding the Earth's population, human population of nearly 7 billion people, and what it has meant to industrial development in countries like the U.S., countries of Europe, and Japan, and what it is now doing for China. It's an amazing story that is summarized in Vaclav Smil's book, Enriching the Earth, which I used heavily to prepare my presentation today. I'll use some direct quotes from this book and other sections I've summarized from and paraphrased in other areas. I also recommend another book, which was written more recently by Thomas Hager, which covers much the same material. When the book by Smil was published in 2001, he was Distinguished Professor of Geography at the University of Manitoba. The book is well referenced with 74 pages of sources for the material throughout the book. Now, what makes nitrogen so important is how essential it is to all life forms and that it is present in living matter at relatively high concentrations. It's a part of protein, amino acids, life's genetic code, and enzymes that are all essential to life. But without human interference, there is typically never enough fixed nitrogen to meet the needs of growing plants that we depend on for food. Nitrogen is also unique among essential mineral plant nutrients in that it is not mined from the earth as the others are. You start with nitrogen gas. Now, what made industrial fixation of nitrogen such a difficult problem was the extremely strong triple bond, a triple bond that prevents it from breaking apart to react from with other elements. Many individuals have had a role in understanding nitrogen as an element and later its role in agriculture, and I'll be brief about these today. Daniel Rutherford, a physician botanist in Edinburgh, Scotland, is generally given credit for discovering nitrogen in 1772, but others noted its properties of non-reactivity around the same time. The French chemist Lavoisier named this element azote, which means without life. By 1790, it was renamed nitrogène, with an E on the end, by another French chemist. Hager, the second book that I noted earlier, in his book described nitrogen pretty well, I thought, and here's a quote from his book. He said, "The oxygen in air makes things rust and burn, and it keeps you alive. Nitrogen, it seemed, did nothing, a reflection of its strong triple bond." Advances in agronomic chemistry knowledge during 1836 to 1853 were from numerous individuals, but three groups had major roles. I think many of you in here are familiar with these people. And those were Boussingault, Liebig, and Laws and Gilbert. Boussingault did both field work and laboratory studies in Alsace, starting in 1836 with considerable emphasis on nitrogen. He concluded that the nutritional value of a nitrogen fertilizer was proportional to its nitrogen content. And he also found that nitrogen was a major component of plants being needed in large quantities. Liebig, meanwhile, was at the center of discussions in agricultural chemistry. He shaped the debate, and he gave high praise to Boussingault's work, but he also stated, in contrast to Boussingault, that there was enough ammonia in air and enough ammonium in soils to meet the requirements of crops. that you didn't need any nitrogen fertilizer. Methods to quantify ammonia in air were not good at that time and no doubt contributed to Liebig's error. Laws and Gilbert settled the question of the need for fertilizer nitrogen when they established the long-term experimental plots at Rothamsted in 1843. 10 years later, in 1853, they published their wheat yield results and clearly showed that plots with only P, K, and magnesium fertilizer yielded the same as unfertilized plots. Plots with P, K, and magnesium plus nitrogen had double the yields. Liebig, however, found it hard to accept these results. The following was taken from Smill's book, a quote from a confidential letter from Liebig to a friend. Liebig wondered, in quotes, how such a set of swindlers, end of quotes, could produce research that is all humbug, most impudent humbug, end of quotes. Of course, Laws had a different opinion. Laws stated in the Journal of the Royal Agricultural Society that it is, in quotes again, hardly possible to have two opinions on the subject, end of quotes. Other work followed by Boussingault and Laws and Gilbert, which showed that both the ammonia in rainfall and adsorption of ammonia by soil from the air could not meet the nitrogen requirements of crops. So it's safe to say that just after the midpoint of the 19th century, just after 1850, it was understood that crops required substantial quantities of nitrogen for vigorous growth, and that grain crops like wheat could yield more when supplied with nitrogen fertilizer. Now, there were other contributions to understanding the nitrogen cycle that continued in the last half of the 1800s. Hellriegel and Wilfarth showed that microorganisms is what gave legumes the ability to fix nitrogen from the air. Winogradsky, a Russian, identified two microorganisms that transformed ammonium to nitrate. And Guyon and his assistants isolated two bacteria that reduced nitrate. So by the end of the 1800s, the qualitative aspects of the nitrogen cycle had been discovered. Quantifying the nitrogen cycle is an equal or greater challenge that I will say, I think many of you would agree, it continues today more than 100 years later. Why the great scientific interest in nitrogen in the 1800s? Besides the scientific curiosity to understand plant growth and plant nutritional needs, there was also the need to ensure food supplies for an expanding population. And progress had been made, mainly by introducing more legumes into crop rotations in Northern Europe. And this introduction took place between 1750 and 1880. Wheat yields in England in the year 1500 were about 500 kilograms of grain per hectare, and they remained at that level into the 1700s. This level of grain yield would contain only about 10 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. Roots, leaves, and stems would probably have contained a similar amount. Now, many of you know that today's estimates of non-symbiotic nitrogen fixation and the small amount of input of ammonium and nitrate by rainfall would be about 15 to 25 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare, just about the right amount to produce that average wheat crop in the year 1500. Think about it. These must have been extremely nitrogen-deficient landscapes. An increase in yield began around 1750 with the introduction of more and better legumes into cropping systems, including clover, alfalfa, and vetch. An example of these changes was given for the county of Norfolk in eastern England, where an approximately constant 13% of the county was sown to legumes from the year 1250 until 1740. By 1836, the percent sown to legumes had more than doubled to 27%, with a great shift to the use of clovers. And, of course, the Norfolk rotation was wheat, turnips, barley, clover, and, of course, then wheat following the clover. Now, Smil quoted from a journal article by a historian, G.P.H. Chorley of the University College in London, regarding the implications of more legume use during this period. And I obtained a copy of this journal article. His journal article, published in the journal Economic History in 1981, was titled The Agricultural Revolution in Northern Europe, 1750 to 1880. This article estimated nitrogen balances in different countries in Northern Europe. So it's interesting that on the one hand, a geographer turned out to be a good agronomist, and here's a historian who also was calculating nitrogen balances. On the last page of his article, Chorley concluded that, and this is in quotes, there was one big change of overriding importance. He's talking about industrial development. Leguminous crops and the consequent increase in the nitrogen supply. He says, it is not fanciful to suggest that this neglected innovation was of comparable significance to steam power in the economic development of Europe in the period of industrialization. And Smil had his own opinion. He stated that Chorley did not exaggerate. And this is a direct quote from Smil's book. Industrialization would not have been possible without population growth, and a higher nitrogen supply allowed not only more people per unit of arable land, but also for the slow but steady improvement of average diets. Now, there were other sources of nitrogen for crop production in the 1800s. Starting around 1850, there was guano, and this was soon followed by sodium nitrate. But these really did not have much influence, did hardly put a dent in the need for nitrogen for crop production at that time. Now, at the end of the 1800s, Great Britain was importing much of its wheat. In 1898, William Crookes, the incoming president, and he was a chemist, by the way, he was the incoming president of the British Association for the Advancement of Science and one of Great Britain's most highly regarded scientists. He spoke about the wheat problem. A couple of quotes from his speech are given here. All civilized nations stand in deadly peril of not having enough to eat. As mouths multiply, food resources dwindle, it is through the laboratory that starvation may ultimately be turned into plenty. The fixation of atmospheric nitrogen is one of the great discoveries awaiting the genius of chemists. The knowledge that ammonia was composed of both nitrogen and hydrogen was over 100 years old by the time Haber considered its synthesis in 1904. And efforts to synthesize ammonia from its components had also received considerable attention for over 100 years, but without any success. Now, the first claim of success was in 1900 by Wilhelm Ostwald. Those of you who have sat through a physical chemistry course may remember this name. He's one of the fathers of physical chemistry. He was a famous German scientist who was a friend of Heinrich von Brunk, who was the general director of BASF in Ludwigshafen in southwestern Germany. And BASF is a really key part of this story. Ostwald claimed to have produced ammonia with an iron catalyst at elevated temperature and pressure. Because of his stature, Ostwald was taken seriously. Von Brunk assigned a recently hired young chemist, Carl Bosch, and this is not a young Carl Bosch, but this is the photo we could find, to check his claim. Bosch concluded that there were impurities of ammonia adsorbed to the iron catalyst that was the source. Although Ostwald later acknowledged his mistake and withdrew his patent, it was shown later that the conditions of the right catalyst with the proper temperature, pressure, and circulation of the synthesis gas would actually work. Therefore, Ostwald later gave himself credit as the intellectual father of the ammonia industry. But the well-defined conditions for ammonia synthesis were to be provided by Fritz Haber. Now, it's important to this story that you know that Fritz Haber was a German Jew. After finishing secondary school, Haber left Breslau, which is now in Poland, but formerly in Germany, to study chemistry. First to the University of Berlin to study organic chemistry, then to Heidelberg, then back to Berlin again. He graduated in 1891 with a doctorate in chemistry. After 1 year of military service and three different industrial chemist positions, he was hired by the Technical University in Karlsruhe in 1894, where he became very productive, publishing 50 papers from 1900 to 1905. He became professor of physical chemistry and electrochemistry in 1906, again at Karlsruhe. It was his very broad experience and his willingness to take on difficult projects that set Haber apart from many of his colleagues. In 1904, Haber did his first work on the reaction of nitrogen with hydrogen to form ammonia under a contract with a chemical company in Vienna. He studied conditions of temperature and catalysts, but at atmospheric pressure. He carried out the work specified in the contract, but then he abandoned the work because of the very low yields of ammonia. He concluded, and he provided this in his report to the Viennese company, that the gas reaction to produce ammonia was not commercially possible. But he did publish his results in 1905. Now, the following year, Walter Nernst, another physical chemist, an upcoming physical chemist who had been one of Ostwald's students, did experiments on ammonia reaction and found much lower yields than those published by Haber. This led to an exchange in communication between them and more experiments to find agreement. But there was no agreement, at least in the mind of Nernst. In May 1907, Nernst publicly humiliated Haber with his very negative remarks about the quality of his data, about the quality of Haber's data, at an important annual scientific society meeting. Of course, Nernst's remarks seriously damaged Haber's reputation. As a result, Haber set out to vindicate his name, and he restarted his experiments, this time studying the effect of pressure as well as temperature and catalysts. A key assistant for Haber in this new work was Robert Le Rossignol from England, who had great skills in building equipment needed for the high-pressure work. Financial support was provided by BASF starting 1 year later in 1908, and Haber and his students studied both the arc process and ammonia synthesis. Now, just want to show this map briefly of Germany. There's Karlsruhe. It's right on the Rhine River here. And the Rhine continues up past Heidelberg. And there's Ludwigshafen. Many of you who have studied about fertilizers know about the explosion at Opal. That was also right next door to Ludwigshafen. And then the other location that I won't really talk about much is Luna in eastern Germany, the other star that you see near Leipzig in the middle right. That was a key factory during World War II and a site of a lot of bombing. Now, BASF at the time was the world's largest chemical company with headquarters in Ludwigshafen. BASF was primarily interested in the arc process to make nitric acid, and they generously funded this part of Haber's work. BASF also reluctantly agreed to fund some of Haber's research on synthesis of ammonia. So BASF they were very skeptical about this, but they agreed anyway to fund some of that work. Now, Haber used this money well and demonstrated success in ammonia synthesis in the lab, which was reported to BASF in a letter dated March 23, 1909. Haber continued to work on the reactor after the March meeting to make further improvements in the process. Now, a few days after Haber's March 23rd letter to BASF, Haber met with key leaders of BASF. He met with the head, who I've mentioned before, Heinrich von Brunk, the lab director, August Bernson, and with Carl Bosch. Note that by this time, Bosch had moved up in the world to consider these kinds of possible breakthroughs. Purpose of the meeting was to consider if the process could be brought to an industrial scale. During the meeting, serious doubts were expressed about running the synthesis very high pressures. When Haber answered a question about the required pressure by saying at least 100 atmospheres, Bernson, who was head of the BASF laboratories, was horrified. 100 atmospheres. This is a quote from the book. Just yesterday, we had an autoclave under only 7 atmospheres flying into the air. When asked his opinion, Bosch answered without hesitation. He said, I believe it can go. I know exactly what the steel industry can do. It should be risked, and that settled the matter. But a later meeting finalized the decision for BASF, and Haber demonstrated his working reactor directly to BASF personnel at Haber's laboratory in Karlsruhe on the historic day of July 2, 1909. Conditions for the demonstration were 100 atmospheres of pressure, 500 degrees Celsius, and an osmium catalyst. Haber achieved 10% yield of ammonia from one pass of nitrogen and hydrogen gas through the reactor. BASF soon bought the world supply of osmium. Now, Carl Bosch brought together an excellent team of chemists and engineers for the project. They were not only able to scale this process up, but they turned Haber's experimental design into a commercial success in less than 4 years. The converter, sitting on Haber's lab bench, was 75 centimeters tall, and it produced 100 grams of ammonia per hour. The converter installed at the first ammonia plant at Opau was 8 meters tall and turned out 200 kilograms of ammonia per hour. To attain commercial production, many difficult problems had to be solved. Nearly all the equipment had to be invented. First, a less expensive catalyst, and after many trials, Alwin Mitosh, I think some of you at least have heard that name before, found a naturally occurring magnetite from Sweden that contained just the right impurities of aluminum, calcium, potassium, and magnesium that combination was as good as osmium. The impurities, referred to as promoters, were essential. A pure magnetite would not work at all. The catalyst used in today's ammonia plants, it turns out, differ very little from Mitosh's final product. Now, another team developed the converter of quality steel and compressors for the extraordinary pressures, valves, gauges, and fittings. All had to be leak-proof under enormous pressures and temperatures. Obtaining pure nitrogen was relatively easy because the technology already existed, but pure hydrogen was another difficult matter because the process to obtain hydrogen resulted in impurities of carbon monoxide, which poisoned the catalyst. An almost insurmountable problem occurred in the first large reactors. I found this very interesting. Hydrogen caused the steel to become brittle and to fail within 3 days. No answer could be found. With all the changes they tried, every oven exploded in a few days. Imagine an oven exploding under 100 atmospheres of pressure. 6 months later, still no progress, until Bosch found a simple solution in his mind one morning. The solution was implemented by placing an inner liner of softer steel and pencil-sized holes in the outer high-quality steel container that allowed hydrogen to fuse out of the reactor should it get through that inner softer steel sleeve. The inner liner was simply replaced periodically with routine maintenance, and so this was another very simple solution to a very complicated problem. Another side note, three rival German chemical companies, including Hoechst, saw the great potential in ammonia synthesis. Now, these companies allied with Nernst, remember Nernst a few minutes ago, and others, including Ostwald, and together they contested Haber's basic patent with a lawsuit. BASF handled this well. Before the trial, BASF offered Nernst an honorarium of 10,000 marks per year for 5 years to serve as an expert consultant on the process. Now, I checked the value of that, and that in today's dollars is about $56,000 per year. So a nice honorarium for 5 years. The trial was held on March the 4th, 1912. Now, following remarks by Ostwald indicating why the patent should be nullified, and what he was saying is that Haber's results were just extrapolation of known concepts. Following these introductory remarks, Nernst and Haber came into the courtroom side by side as if they were the best of friends. Nernst then testified that Haber had broken new ground with his research and that Haber's patent dealt with results of a completely new type. The lawsuit was dismissed and BASF had full rights to the process. So apparently that money helped. The ammonia plant at Opal moved into full production during early 1914, and the output of ammonium sulfate was quickly sold for use in agriculture. Then World War I began, and the demand for nitrates for explosives rose quickly. The process to make nitrates for explosives was added at Opal, and this is something that Ostwald did have the patent on, and it was his process. According to both Smil and Hager, the invention of ammonia synthesis for agriculture greatly lengthened World War I because of its use in making explosives. At the end of the war in 1918, the plant at Opal was partly dismantled and moved across the Rhine to keep the secrets of the process from the French. This was because, according to the armistice agreement that was signed between the Germans and the Allies at the end of the war, is that the French occupation was to stop at the Rhine River. The French made notes and measurements of what was left at the plant after they moved all the key parts across the river, but it did not help them. In negotiations at Versailles in 1919, and this was to discuss reparations for World War I, Bosch was a representative of German industry, and in a backroom deal, he offered to the French to provide details to build a Haber-Bosch plant. This helped in reparations with the French. By the early 20s, the French were producing ammonia, and after secrets from the process spread from the French to the British, two Haber-Bosch plants were also running in England by December of 1923. Around this time, the U.S. also became involved and built plants to produce ammonia, so the technology was spreading very rapidly. Now, there were also setbacks to BASF. After returning from France in 1919, Bosch became chairman of the BASF board, in part because of the negotiating skills he had demonstrated at Versailles. As chairman of BASF, he had to deal with an explosion at the Opal ammonia plant that caused more than 500 fatalities and destroyed the homes of more than 7,000 people in 1921. This was a great personal blow to Bosch, who had worked so hard to perfect ammonia synthesis. And then it had caused so much death and destruction. Plant examiners found that the explosion was centered in a storage silo for fertilizer. The silo primarily contained ammonium sulfate, but after the war, some sodium nitrate production was continued because many farmers preferred it, and it was mixed with the ammonium sulfate in the silo, which BASF chemists had shown to be safe when small explosive charges were used to break apart the caked fertilizer. But they were wrong. 4,500 tons of ammonia, of fertilizer in the silo, blew up. During the 1920s, Bosch traveled widely and received a large number of honors and awards for his work. The high point of was his receipt of the Nobel Prize in 1932. The Nobel Prize in chemistry had never been given for work aimed directly at achieving technical improvements in a process. Technical progress tends to be an outcome of cooperation among several individuals, and therefore it is usually difficult to decide on the most deserving person. But this was different. Technical advance in this case was of great importance, and it was really quite clear as to Bosch's extraordinary role. Carl Bosch shared the prize with Frederick Burgess, the inventor of coal hydrogenation, for their services in originating and developing chemical high-pressure methods. At that time, Hitler's seizure of power was a shocking surprise to Bosch, who favored more moderate politicians. After the takeover, Bosch tried to protect Jewish scientists and businessmen, arguing for freedom of research and for international economic cooperation in his only meeting with Hitler. Hitler had a special way if he was displeased with his audience. He just invited one of his people in and said, Mr. So-and-so wishes to leave. And that's what happened to Bosch. Bosch refused to join the Nazi Party. At a later meeting of Hitler's Economic Council, Hitler entered the meeting room, and when he learned that Bosch was to speak when he was on the program, Hitler promptly left and the meeting was closed. Hitler's Economic Council never met again. Painkillers and alcohol were Bosch's way of dealing with deepening depression and fear about the future. On April the 20th, 1940, with Bosch critically ill, his son was summoned from Berlin. The next day, he told his son what he foresaw. And this is taken directly from the book. To begin with, this is Bosch speaking to his son. To begin with, it will go well. But then he will bring the greatest calamity by attacking Russia. Even that will go well for a while. But then I see terrible things. Everything will be totally black. The sky is full of airplanes. They will destroy whole Germany, its cities, its factories, and also the IG. The IG was a conglomeration of the major German chemical companies. Bosch died 6 days later. In contrast to Bosch's life, Haber's fate already turned tragic during World War I. Haber moved to Berlin in 1911 and became a member of an emerging class of elite science managers. Even before the end of 1914, he began working on gas warfare by taking over and expanding the experiments begun prior to that time. Now, the Hague Conventions of 1899 and 1907 forbade the use of poisonous gas in war, but this did not stop Haber. The German government decided to use gases in war, and Haber made sure that their deployment was technically possible. He believed that the use of chlorine gas against enemy troops would speed victory for Germany and end the war sooner. During World War I, 1.3 million people died from gas warfare. If this bothered Haber, he never said it in any speeches. In his post-war writings and speeches, he never apologized for his work on gas warfare. Now, when Haber was announced as the winner of the Nobel Prize in 1918 for ammonia synthesis, it was not well received, because by then he was known as the inventor of gas war in France, England, and in the United States. The award ceremony was postponed to 1920, and it took place not in the fall, but on Nobel's birthday of June 1. Now, this is a quote from Smil. He said, "Three generations later, Haber's acceptance speech still reads as a masterful overview of the challenge and the solution to one of the key limiting factors in the growth of modern civilization. It may be that this solution is not the final one. Nitrogen bacteria teach us that nature, with her sophisticated forms of chemistry of living matter, still understands and utilizes methods which we do not as yet know how to imitate." End of quotes. Haber's last years were difficult. The worst occurred April 7, 1933, when a law passed that made it impossible for the German government to employ anyone of non-Aryan descent, meaning no people who were Jews. Haber had no choice but to resign his post as director of the Institute. Max Planck personally intervened with Hitler on his behalf, but to no avail. Haber died the next year, a despondent man. Now, today's modern ammonia plant is large, often producing over 1,000 tons per day, and it is highly efficient. It takes about 0.65 tons of natural gas to make 1 ton of ammonia. The overall reaction is exothermic and highly efficient, in part because about 40% of the hydrogen comes from water, as can be seen in the overall reaction here. The nitrogen, of course, is from the air. Even more efficient is what nature can do with the nitrogen that is supplied to crops. An example shown in the second column, and this is work from Glenn Burton and his colleagues, published in the 1950s with coastal Bermuda grass. Shown in the second column is the increase in dry matter over the next lower rate of nitrogen, which was a check plot. The first number, 7,261 kilograms per hectare, is the increase in yield of coastal Bermuda grass over the control plot. Now, it took 73 kilograms of methane to produce the 112 kilograms of fixed nitrogen. That gave the 7,261 kilograms of dry matter. Or if you divide those numbers, 99 kilograms of dry matter was produced by the investment of 1 kilogram of methane. This is an impressive return on investment. In terms of carbon sequestration, which many in our membership are interested in, and I am myself, if you assume that the dry matter was 40% carbon, then 40 kilograms of carbon was sequestered by photosynthesis for each kilogram of methane used in the nitrogen manufacture. Haber-Bosch has also had an impressive effect on modern crop yields for food and feed grain crops, and I'll use two examples. The first is a change in the yield of wheat in England from 1945 to 1998. It shows the yields were about 2 tons per hectare in 1945, and they rose steadily to 8 tons per hectare in 1998. The correlation with nitrogen fertilizer rates of application, also shown in this slide, changing steadily from 20 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare in 1945 to about 180 kilograms per hectare in 1998. That correlation is obvious from the data. You don't have to run a correlation on this data. Those lines are side by side. I'm guessing the biggest part of the increase in yield of the 1,000 kilograms of grain per hectare in English wheat from 1845 to 1945, remember earlier in the talk, the yields in the mid-1800s was 1,000 kilograms of grain per hectare. Now by 1945, they're 2,000. That increase of 1,000 was probably due to the 20 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare applied in 1945 versus near zero in 1845. In fact, the increase of 1,000 kilograms of grain per hectare would contain almost exactly 20 kilograms of nitrogen, assuming 2% nitrogen in the grain. Corn grain in the U.S. is a similar story. Shown on this slide is the corn grain yield from 1868. I don't think you can see those numbers on the x-axis because there's so many of them. But it starts at 18, the data actually started at 1866, and the yields are averaged 5 years at a time, a running average. Shown is the yield up until the present time. Now, the grain yield was about 25 bushels per acre over that 70-year period from 1868 to 1938. After that time, yields began to increase slowly, but then increased at a faster rate from about 1960 until the present time. Now, no doubt the introduction of hybrid corn in the 1930s had a significant role. Web sources associated with Pioneer Hybrid Seed Company indicated that 90% of the corn planted in the U.S. by 1940 was hybrid rather than open-pollinated. But you don't see huge increases in the yield in 1940. But I want to give all due credit to any plant breeders in the audience that they play a major role as well. But the big factor, as with wheat production in England, was nitrogen fertilizer use, as shown in this slide. Yields increased at a modest and continuous rate from the early 1940s until 1960, as did nitrogen fertilizer use. Nitrogen fertilizer use increased at a faster rate starting around 1960, and you can see that it's on the U.S. is on the left side. And corn yields also picked up about 1960, shown again here. A big change in the ammonia manufacturing plants began to take place in the 1960s. The energy used to make ammonia in the new ammonia plants in 1970 was only 65% of what it had been 15 years earlier, and less than half of pre-World War II plants. And of course, this was because of the introduction of centrifugal compressors rather than piston compressors and other changes. This increase in efficiency allowed exceptionally low retail prices for nitrogen fertilizer at that time. My older brother, John Kissel, remarked to me recently that he paid $65 per ton cash price when he farmed in southwestern Indiana in 1969. That's 4 cents per pound of nitrogen for anhydrous ammonia. With low prices for nitrogen fertilizer and a relatively good price for corn, yields increased continuously over the next 30 years. By 2010, the average yields were nearly 160 bushels per acre, which is more than a six-fold increase in yield in a period of 70 years. If Chorley, the economic historian cited earlier, had concluded that the doubling of wheat yields from 1750 to 1880 was of equal significance to the development of steam power for industrial development, what would he say about the six-fold increase in yields in the 20th century? Some economic data can be very informative. The other line on the graph was the price of corn. That's the red line. Normalized to the value of $2,010. The low point on the graph around 2003 was the price of about $2.50 per bushel. The market price of corn has been trending downward from 1948 until 2005, with only one significant price increase around 1978. A similar price drop over the time period also occurred for wheat and rice. Of course, the effect of greatly increased supply and the efficiencies of production due to nitrogen fertilizer, and here I must add the role of all other factors. Plant breeding, pest control, mechanization obviously had a big role, irrigation, and other plant nutrients, very surely, have all made the higher yields and increased efficiencies of production possible. But if you leave nitrogen out of the picture, none of this would have happened. The net result of all these improvements is a reduced price, as shown by this supply-demand curve, typically used by economists to describe the interaction of supply and demand on the price of a commodity. As the supply increased, the price went down. Of course, you push that supply curve to the right, and the price will go down. In 1930, nearly 25% of income was spent on food. But this percent has dropped over the intervening 75 years to less than 10% today. Another significant result of these greatly increased efficiencies has been the number of people fed by one farmer. In 1940, the average output from one farmer fed 20 people. That figure has risen continuously over the years to over 150 people today. The net result of fewer people producing less expensive food is that our society has been able to produce and afford other goods and services that makes life easier and more enjoyable. Do the improvements in food production efficiency also hold true for a recently developing, industrializing country like China? China is an interesting case. Mao Zedong instituted a plan in the 1950s to remake Chinese society by moving millions of people from farm to city to work in the factories. Food would be produced on large communes. This change took place in 1958 to 62 when population was growing and weather was very unsettled. They had both droughts and floods, which resulted in a food shortage. Many people starved, perhaps 30 million. Records are not readily available on this. I did pick up another source. It said from 15 to 45 million, but it, you know, probably that 30 million is a good number. This disaster was dealt with by moving people back to the countryside, but by the early 1970s, a repetition seemed about to occur. Then, following President Nixon's visit in 1972, China began trade with the U.S., and the first order of business was for China to purchase 13 of the world's biggest and most modern Haber-Bosch nitrogen plants. Today, the Chinese are generally eating well, and many of you in here have probably been to China. Industry clearly is developing very quickly. There are other unintended consequences to this story. In some respects, nitrogen has become overly abundant. Matusik and others describe the fixation of nitrogen by the human activities listed here. Fertilizer manufacture each year is 100 million tons. Modern legumes like soybeans and alfalfa contribute another 40, and burning of fossil fuels adds another 20, according to them. This total of 160 million tons is about 55 to 60% of all nitrogen fixed each year. In other words, humans have more than doubled the amount of nitrogen fixation in the past 100 years. And much of this nitrogen is concentrated on our best agricultural land in an environment where nitrogen may be lost by nitrate leaching, some of which may reach the marine environment and cause eutrophication. Also, there can be ammonia volatilization from both fertilizers and animal manures, which may cause eutrophication and soil acidification in the case of very poorly buffered forest soils. And finally, some nitrogen may be lost as nitrous oxide by denitrification. And, of course, nitrous oxide is a strong greenhouse gas. But, of course, we cannot do without nitrogen fertilizer. According to the book, we have probably 2 to 3 billion additional people on the earth today that we would not be here without this process. The nitrogen loss issues are well known to most in the audience here today. Many of you have contributed substantially to understanding these loss mechanisms, reducing losses while also maximizing crop production. The central challenge is to apply the right rate of nitrogen for the crop being grown. As I noted earlier, this means doing a better job of quantifying some components of the nitrogen cycle. Perhaps the most important is quantifying the amount of nitrogen that becomes available from soil humus and decomposing crop residues in the soil. Because these processes are so complex due to their dependence on environmental conditions, perhaps better solutions will come from the integration of computer technology, weather data, and soil and plant analysis. These challenges should be no greater than those facing Haber and Bosch 100 years ago. Thank you very much.